The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
And our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch. Meredith and I were briefly talking about how our childhood was really rewarding to us, and we had such a wonderful childhood. So in today's world being so chaotic, I really relish my time learning how to really connect with my mule. So this is an appropriate topic. So we're going to talk about the language of long ears, and Meredith, you go with it.
Okay, this is going to be a touchy subject, and no doubt we're going to make some people angry. I can see no other way, but it has to be said. Because a long time ago, when we were growing up, there were wide open spaces. I lived in an area where there were a lot of dairy farms and a lot of open spaces, country roads with 8 to 10 foot shoulders on the road. People used to drive their cars along these little roads that we would ride on. But when they saw us along the side of the road, they would slow down and just crawl past us and wave and say hi. And they were just really friendly people. Then there were people along the road, and if it was a hot day, Mrs. Johnson would wave us up the driveway and give each of us a glass of lemonade, you know, and then we'd sit there and talk to her for a while. Mr. Brown, who owned the apple orchard, really didn't like us taking a shortcut across his apple orchard. So he would come out on the porch and shoot his rifle, his shotgun, into the air to scare us off his property.
Oh boy.
It made for a really exciting ride, you know, if nothing else. But he didn't shoot at us. It was all in good humor.
Good.
Yeah. And then, you know, this is back in the 60s when the hippies were putting together their communes and stuff. And just so happens there was a commune right down the road from where I lived. What we used to do is we'd call each other in the morning, and then we'd make arrangements to take picnic lunches with us and fill up our saddlebags with sandwiches and things to drink and all of that, and then we'd hit the road. And a lot of times we'd go up to this commune and let all the hippie kids ride the horses. And they really had a really good time, and then they would let us go ahead and pick apples and pears and peaches and things and cherries out of the cherry trees that they had on their property. So we would just ride the horses underneath the trees and stand on their backs and pick the fruit and eat it, and then we'd be on our way. And everybody got along really, really well. So it was a fun time, and people were really kind to each other. And you just don't see that anymore. And I gotta say that the thought of even having a phone on your animal while you were riding back then never entered our minds at all. What I have noticed these days is these cell phones are total distractions.
Oh, sure.
Now, getting back to when I was just going to clinics and everything back then, too. I would take my animals to clinics, and I thought that was a lot of fun and everything. You know, I'd get into a clinic, and I'd realize that I was only one of 20 people in this clinic. So you didn't get a whole lot of attention in the clinic. The instructors were teaching this and teaching that. And so it was a really limited learning experience. And to pass any kind of information on to anybody else was difficult, because that kind of learning experience is full of holes. And our animals, they can't just be pushed around and forced into doing things that it doesn't start creating resistance and problems to the animal. And then when you get into something like that, then you put yourself at risk of being hurt. Or the animal gets hurt, or you both get hurt. So that was when I decided that maybe this business of going to clinics and doing things the standard way really wasn't all that. And it seemed to me that these horse trainers were keeping a lot of secrets, too. And when I would ask about them, they would say, oh, well, you don't need to know that because that will get you in a dangerous situation. And we're here to help you with that stuff. So if you can't make your animal do this, that, or the other, we have ways to go ahead and make them do it, and then we can train them for you and give them back to you. Well, of course, they charge you for that,
you know? Right.
So this became a way for trainers to become indispensable and to make money off the general public. And then they would turn these animals back to the people with the idea that they were going to be tuned up, ready to ride, and all of this. But what they neglected to realize was that the trainers knew all the tricks and everything on how to make these animals do what they wanted. But the people they were training for didn't have the knowledge to do it, to carry it out. When the animals got home, they would stick pretty good and be okay at first, but then the training would fall apart, and then, of course, you'd have to take the animal back to the trainer again and do another tune-up, which cost you another $1,000 or so, and it was just eating up your savings, and you weren't really learning anything. And as a trainer, I decided that I was going to make sure that my clients were learning what I was teaching their animals, so I insisted that they come and work with me and their animals so that they would learn how to do the things that I was doing with their animals the way that I was doing it so that they could get the same kinds of results that I was getting. We just went ahead and that worked okay for a time, I suppose. But then a lot of people started getting a little angry with me because I was giving away secrets that the trainers were the only ones that were supposed to know about this.
Yeah.
But I told them, I said, yeah, but these people need to learn this. What I would do too is that I kept records and diaries and photographs and video of everything that I did. And since I didn't have a trainer or an instructor at the time, it was helpful for me to have these videos to write down all these little things that I got involved with that were causing problems with my animals, because then I could look back on it and go, oh, well, this is what I did here. Well, maybe if I change it up a little bit, I can do it differently and get different results. I began doing my books and videos. My mission was to train and show mules in every equestrian discipline, and that expanded beyond my wildest dreams. I was competing against horses with these mules. Because I kept all these notes and everything, and questioned everything that I learned, I learned how to do a lot of new things different ways. It really yielded some incredible results with my mules. One of the first things I ran into, too, was the people that were training horses were going, oh, don't give your animal any rewards. They're going to bite you, you know. And everything that they seemed to be telling me were things that came out of fear. Oh, if you hand feed that animal, they're going to bite you. It was not that they were going to bite me. It was if I didn't do it carefully, sure they'd bite me. But if I did it carefully and in a timely fashion following something that they accomplished, then it worked just fine. Mules are typically a whole lot stronger in their head and their neck and their whole body, actually. So a lot of times you couldn't force them to do things. And when I was finally taking dressage lessons from my dressage instructor, she taught me that all the different ways that I could get my mule to collect his body and start to slow it down, more suspension to his gait, more regularity of his gait and cadence. Because he'd had reining training before that, and he learned that when he went to do a flying change, if he missed it, he would run away. So I started using draw reins, and my instructor about had a fit. And she goes, oh, you can't use those. I said, well, I can't do it without these things. I mean, I've got good hands. I'm not dragging on him, and I'm talking to him. And that was the other thing, too, is you learn to use your verbal speech to talk to these guys and kind of calm them down a little bit while you're doing these things. And you go, oh, yeah, I know this is hard, but we can do this. Let's just slow down a little bit and let's do this. And so we were incorporating speech with the animals, and I learned that if I kept the words in the beginning one syllable shortened up, then I didn't get the resistance that I would if I was yelling and cussing at them.
Right,
you know,
right.
So I would just use walk on, whoa, back, walk, trot, canter, and all those things. And as long as I did that, then they actually learned the language. And it clicked in my head that maybe they learn just like little kids do in grammar school. You know, they learn their ABCs, then they learn words, then they learn sentences, and then pretty soon paragraph. And I was amazed to see that yes, they were expanding their verbal understanding as long as I kept things simple and didn't expand on it too fast. The other thing that I noticed was that I could see that they understood what I was saying because their own body language told me about that. We would have tours here, and we would take people down into the barn, and people would make these comments and say, for instance, a lot of people thought that their ears were really funny because they were really big. And so I would open the stall door, and of course I taught them good manners, so they'd stand right in the stall, and they wouldn't barge out. They would wait, and then I would give them their reward for standing there. And then if a guest looked at them and said, oh, what a funny-looking animal, they would splay their ears in a most dejected sort of a way and lower their heads and look like they'd been insulted. Their eyes that were bright and shiny and interested all of a sudden became dull, and they kind of felt like people were making fun of them. And then when we had people that were really interested in them and weren't put off by their ears or anything, and they would say something, and they'd go, oh, look at how cute they are.
Yeah.
Then they would stand up tall and straight and perk their ears, you know, and go, look at me, you know, look at me. I'm really cool. And you see that they really, really understood these things. Now, a lot of people get really scared, too, when they go out in the pasture with their mules, and especially with mule babies. Babies are notorious for chasing you with their ears laid back. And a lot of people get really afraid of them because they think they're mean. They've heard in life, for instance, that if an equine lays their ears back, that they're mad. But that's not necessarily true. It's how far are they laid back, and are they relaxed ears or are they stiff back?
Mm.
And when they're stiff back, the thing that will go along with that is you will see wrinkles around the nostrils, like they're mad and they're wrinkling up their nose at you and they're pulling their upper lip back over their teeth.
Yeah.
Now that does mean that they're mad.
Right.
But when they're just laying their ears back and they're chasing you and their muzzle is relaxed and they're just blowing flared nostrils at you because they're running, that just means, hey, we're playing a game. You want to go play this game? Come on, play with me. You know, and that's what they mean. And then when you've got a youngster, too, they don't know that they're not supposed to kick you. So they get all excited about the game, and they'll spin around and kick in the air.
Sure.
But if you notice that they usually will not make a connection, a foot may go flying past your ear, but it won't hit you. If they mean to hit you and connect with you, they surely will. They are that good at aiming. you know, and if you get kicked in, you know, anywhere on your body, in the shoulder, in the ear, in the leg or anything like that, then you can pretty well assume that they meant to hit you and that they were just warning you, hey, you're getting too close. This is not part of the game. And so you learn to read these things with them. And 9 times out of 10, mules and donkeys just want to play. They're very affectionate animals. They really like being around people. And they're not mean. They're just not mean unless you get mean with them.
Right.
And if you get mean with them, then you deserve what you get, you know? I had a farrier that was very impatient with my mules. I had to let him go, but I had a yearling mule, April, and April was a sweet thoroughbred mule, but she did not like that farrier, and we were standing in the run. He was between me and April, and she spun around to kick him, and he darted out of the way. And she landed her foot right in the middle of my thigh. And you should have seen the horror on her face, man. She was like, oh, my God, I hit the mom. You know, and she put her head all the way down to the ground and splayed those ears and was looking up through her eyes at me. Go, I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't mean to do that. Yeah. And I went, well, that's okay, April. I know you didn't mean to do it. And then she was okay. They can learn a language if you're willing to really spend the time to evaluate what it is they're really, what they really mean by their body language. They do have feelings. They do react to what we say, and when we do teach them in a slow and meticulous way what language is all about, they can learn it. They learn what we mean by what we say. They just can't speak English. Their mouths aren't made that way.
Right.
And so they, you know, you just realize that, you know, That's just the way it is. If you look at them like body language is the most important part of all the languages that we use with these guys, animals will mirror you and react to what your body is telling them. If you position yourself in front, you can turn them or stop them. If you walk up to them in an aggressive way, they will show fear. If you go through a gate or the stall door and wait with an inviting attitude, they'll come to you. Of course, learning accurate body language is a responsibility that we must put upon ourselves to really be effective. We got to practice it. And you practice by going ahead and reacting in certain ways and then seeing how that affects your mule. What kind of reactions are you getting from him? And then he can tell you if your body language is accurate or not. If I got a negative response, for instance, then I would just change my approach until I got it right. And when I got it right, so did they. Touching them was another thing. I had to learn all about how they like to be touched, and that's why I talk about imprinting beyond birth. Imprinting is not just something you do after they're born. It's an ongoing process because you've got a lot of things that you're going to put your animal in contact with. The most obvious is your tack and equipment. And how you put it on and how you tighten those straps and how you adjust everything, even the bridle, when you bring the bridle up over the crown and got those long ears, you know, I've learned that they're much more willing to not get head shy if you take the bridle, the crown piece in your left hand, and take your right hand and put it, cup the ear behind and bend it forward in the palm of your hand and run that crown piece over your hand instead of over their ear. They learn really quickly that you're trying to avoid hurting their ears.
Sure.
And they won't get head shy. Mm. They know what you're trying to do. Touch needs to be empathetic, but firm enough to do the job. and it's a powerful tool. It can be soothing and relieve anxiety. It can be pleasurable or painful. Touch can indicate direction depending on how it's used. We begin with imprinting or touching of the foal all over its body, but this isn't just the beginning and the end of imprinting. Imprinting sets the stage for the kind of interaction you and your equine will have during your entire life together, and can often bridge a gap of misunderstanding when the two languages are not working. Never was this more apparent to me than just recently. Little Jack Horner got to be 30 years old, for instance. I went through all of the touch, all of the five senses, talking to him, the verbal, hearing, even the taste of the oats. I mean, he could smell when he was going to get a reward and all of that. So I used the five senses very conscientiously, but we were going to do some filming and I needed to hitch him up to the Meadowbrook cart, but I hadn't driven him for probably 2 years. Here he was 30 years old. It might have been even longer than that. And I hitched him up to the Meadowbrook cart, got in the cart and pulled the reins, and he turned out of the station where I hitched him, and then he walked forward and I was going, whoa, whoa, as we're going towards the round pen fence, and I was hollering, whoa, but he wasn't stopping, and he ran right into the fence. Whoa. And I went, oh my God, what's going on here? Well, I determined that he had gone deaf.
Uh-oh.
He couldn't hear me. He couldn't hear a word I was saying. I had my ranch manager give me my driving whip. I went ahead and pulled on the reins, alternate pressure, and got him to back up. He knew what that meant. And then I used my whip on the side of his body to turn him, and I used it right over his back to make him go forward, and on the other side to make him go the opposite direction. And even though he couldn't hear me, he could feel the whip on the sides, and he did everything the right way from the whip. And so all of these little pieces of this communication, spending the time that I did with him as we were growing together, it really, really made a huge difference. So he didn't really have to hear me. He could do everything I wanted him to. He always did whatever, and even when we were doing the jumping and everything, it was easier for him to know what I meant when I was riding him, because I had control over his posture and everything with the reins, with my legs and everything, so I could actually have total control of him. Jumping and things like that were not an issue. I could go ahead and do those things, and he really didn't have to hear me. He could just follow my directions in the other ways.
Wow.
And I thought this was pretty amazing, actually, that he learned that much. I just cut back his work, and eventually, after he went over 20 years old and just spent the next 14 years, he died at 34, but we just did occasional rides around the ranch, and because he was getting older and weaker, a lot of times I just wouldn't even use the saddle anymore. I'd just get on him bareback and ride him that way, and he was fine with that because it didn't bog him down. It was a matter of being polite and considerate to him, and considering his age and considering what he was going to be asked to do. I know that in this day and age, we are inundated with big tech and we are inundated with computers. And I look upon these things, although all of these techies thought they were going to give us an advanced way to communicate with each other, I don't think it ended up being what they thought it was going to be. And they will even admit that now,
sure,
that what they thought was going to be an enhanced way of communication has turned out to be an enhanced way to ignore each other. You have people that are walking down the street street with their face in their phones, and they're texting each other instead of just turning around and talking to each other. When you're texting each other, or when you're just typing emails or anything like that, you cannot explain things in detail. So people don't really know what you mean. They can only guess. So that really takes away any kind of detailed communication that really explains explicitly what you mean. And when you're working with an animal, it becomes even more important. Here we are, and our society has exploded. We've got a population explosion, and the cities have gotten really big. A lot of people don't even have the ground or the land to work with their animals. So they're forced to put them in boarding stables. And then to exasperate that kind of a situation, I know here in Colorado several years back, they decided that the government had to have their fingers into everything. Mm-hmm. And they were making laws here. They had a lot of people that were moving on to 5-acre lots. And they thought, oh, good, we can have a horse now. And they would put up a 6-stall barn, but they'd only have like 2 or 3 horses. And they go, oh, well, I can help to subsidize this by renting the extra stalls to people that live in the subdivisions and don't have anywhere to keep their animals. I went to a meeting about this, and the county was up there, and they were saying how they did not think that these people on these lots should be able to rent the stalls to anyone. So here these people are with 2 or 3 horses and some extra stalls, but they're not allowed to rent the stalls to anybody because that opened up a whole new ball of worms. And they decided that the county would have to be paid taxes for the people that were using the stalls if they were in fact going to do this. They got into the boarding stables, and they started, the boarding stables were huge. And when I moved here in 1980, there were more horses per capita in this area, right here where I live, than anywhere else in the United States. And when they started doing this meeting, charging registration fees for boarding stables, they were charging $15,000 a year for boarding stables to operate. Well, if you understand how much it costs to board your animal, back then it was probably about $400 to $600 a month for the boarding stable to get enough money from the clients to feed their horses. And that's just talking about feeding. That's not even counting having people do turnout or anything like that, or exercising your animal for you if you need it, and all of these other services that boarding stables used to do. And so it got so bad that these boarding stables started closing down and going to Texas. We don't have a whole lot of big boarding stables around here anymore. And the people that have these 5-acre lots can't rent their extra stalls to anybody anymore, but they still have to pay to have their horses there. And then the property taxes are elevated because they've got horses on their property. So it seems like what they're doing is they're just trying to get tax money for the government any way they can.
Oh, sure.
Another problem that arose too was that we out here in the Midwest grow crops for food. We grow hay for our animals. We grow corn and barley and all these other foods that get, and even orchards to supply the grocery stores and everything. But then, the people in the cities decided they're going to get really smart and they're going to do hydroponics. Then they decide they're going to go and wage a war on fossil fuels, and with the idea that everything is going to be solar or wind or anything like that. But do they take on nuclear energy? No, that's too scary. In an effort to really control all of this, what they have done is they have made it next to impossible for the farmers and ranchers to do their jobs. And that's basically to provide food for the general population. And then we want to ride our animals and everything. And if you're living on a ranch, you got to ride your animals to go after those cattle. Those cattle spend the summer up in the high country, and then they have to come down in the fall so that they can winter in the lowlands where it's not quite so cold and harsh. In some of those places, you can't get a tractor in there or a four-wheeler or anything like that. You got to ride in and ride out.
Sure.
And that's all part of the thing. It's not just riding for fun. It's riding from the necessities that the settlers had when they first moved out here on the plains. And when they were starting their ranches and their farms, this was the protocol. Farmers that didn't have enough kids in their family could borrow kids from the neighbors, and everybody helped everybody else because everybody needed to be able to survive. And we got some pretty harsh winters out here, and we had to make sure that everybody got their crops in, everybody got their calves calved, you know, or their heifers calved, and that the cattle were sold, that they were taken to market, that all of these things worked like clockwork. And they didn't get all messed up until the urban people started thinking that they could do all this their own way. So when they started doing that, then the production of the farms and the ranches started to decline. In the case of the mules, people thought mules were just mean and nasty and ornery, and that was the gossip of the day. The rumor of the day is these things are just not very cool animals at all. I determined that I thought they were pretty cool because I got along with them really well. And that made me think that these guys, these farmers and ranchers that got along with the mules and they made the mules work, and the mules would work too. Oh my God, they would. They would plow those fields, and the farmer could just walk along behind the plow and the mule would do all the work. He didn't have to steer him. He'd learn his job and then he'd do it.
Right.
You know, and the mule would also know when it was the end of the day and to stop plowing, and he would just halt. Stop right where he was, turn around, and head for home.
Like,
you know, because he knew.
Right.
It determined an amazing relationship between these farmers and ranchers and their mules. And a lot of these guys preferred to use mules on their ranches. And in the military, particularly, while Bill Cody rode a mule named Mouse and rode with General Custer across the country, and
yeah,
and Custer was riding a thoroughbred that got real tired after that trek. But while Bill Cody had to go back to the fort, so he just turned around where he was and rode all the way home. You know, so Mouse went both ways. You know, and that was totally cool. And I had some friends here that were asking me one time, they said, well, we've got to move these cattle from the high country down to the low country now in the fall. We're kind of short of some people here. We've only got two of us. We've got a whole lot of cattle. Would you care to help us? And I thought, yeah, sure. Me and Dee will help you. And they go, you're going to ride that mule? I said, well, of course I'm going to ride my mule. What else would I ride? You know, and they go, well, I guess. I went ahead and I got my saddle bags and my saddle, and I packed everything up in the trailer and then loaded up the mule on the trailer with all my stuff. When I packed up my saddle bags, I made sure that I had rain gear, that I had fence pliers, that I had sandwiches, something to drink, water, all the necessities that you would need if you were up in the mountains, because we were going to be up there for a while. You know, those cattle don't always stay together. They can be down in the gullies, they can be out in the meadow, they can be all over, and sometimes we had to split up to go find them.
Oh,
and there was only three of us. We went up there, and here's the other thing a lot of people don't know either, because they watch too many movies, and they think that you can just get in behind a herd of cattle and start running them down the hill. That's not what you want to do. Right. You want to keep them walking. Mm-hmm. You keep them calm. You keep them walking. And then if you discover that you may have to check a gully or something like that and make sure there's no cattle down there, or that there's not a calf that's stuck somewhere, you've got to be able to just get the herd to just stop where they are and graze. And then you go after the strays and you bring them into the herd as you work your way down the hill. We're working our way down the hill. The guys I was with, they were on horses, and they go, "Oh, your mule's doing pretty okay, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I think she's doing fine." And they both looked at me over their shoulders and said, "She's going a little slow, though." And I said, "Well, okay, whatever. I mean, the cattle are walking, so why shouldn't we walk? That's fine." All of a sudden, something spooked the herd, and they took off running across this meadow. Well, we thought they were going to just go to the end of the meadow, but they didn't. They hooked it to the right and started going towards the forest. Mm. Where they went, there was a tree down. This tree was about 3 feet in diameter, laying on its side, and the cattle just split and went through the brush on either side of it. And my friends were galloping after them with the horses, and they came to a sliding stop right in front of this tree while the cattle were barging through the underbrush on either side of it. I came galloping up on my mule, and I just went straight between those two horses and up and over the tree.
Good for you.
Yeah, and I came in right behind the cattle, and then the cattle found a break in a fence. And they went through and onto this other person's property. I just followed them, and then I looped them around, and I made them circle and slow down a little bit. And once I got them at a walk again, I headed them towards the opening in the fence and put them back through the fence on the right side. And then the guys came up after trying to find their way through the underbrush, and I just looked at them. I go, "Well, where were you guys?" They go, "Oh, well, we had to go around." I said, "Oh, too bad you can't jump a 3-foot tree, huh?" I said, "But we better fix this fence here." And the guys go, "Well, how are we going to do that?" And I reached into my saddlebag and I pulled out my fence pliers and I said, "How about with these?" And they go, "Oh, I forgot to bring mine." I said, "Yeah, well, we don't need 2 pair. We can just use these." And so we did. We fixed the fence and then took the cattle the rest of the way down the hill, and everything went fine, you know. But they were quite impressed with the way me and my mule worked cattle in the open range. You know, I was proud of it. But then we had our relationship, too, that we had spent years developing. And when you spend the time with your animals, mules and donkeys and horses like that, then you do establish a relationship that is safe for both of you. Now, trying to avoid all these times together because you're afraid you're going to get hurt is not the way to do it. Having a trainer train your animal so that you can ride it is pretty unrealistic, because these animals are not like cars. You cannot tune them up and then give them to each other to drive.
Right.
That it doesn't work. These are personal relationships. You do need to have a certain amount of exposure to each other. And yes, they're big. And yes, going to have experiences that can be a little daunting sometimes. Now, when we used to go down and ride down the roads and stuff when I was younger, you know, we had young kids riding with us. Some of the kids that rode with us were like 4 and 5 years old. Our parents didn't worry about us back then. The older kids took care of the younger kids. The horses were used to being ridden. They were used to us running around between their legs and everything, and they would try really hard not to step on us. It was fairly safe riding around like that. We didn't have all these crazy people running around. And people helped each other. This was the important thing that was going on. Parents would kind of look after each other's children, whether you were in the city or whether you were in the country. It really, really didn't matter. Everybody was there to help everybody else. And we could be gone all day long as we were home for dinner. The parents wouldn't start worrying until he didn't come home for dinner.
Right.
That was fine. The other thing is in doing all of this riding all day and everything, and then coming home for dinner and having all of this food that we grew on the land and having meat packing houses where the cattle were slaughtered, the meat was processed correctly, without additives and things like that. It was healthy. If you think about what people looked like back in those days, you can think about the hippies in the 60s, and there were not very many fat hippies. They were skinny for the most part, and they were constantly dancing and doing physical exercise. Those of us that had animals, we were riding, and we were physically fit. And not only that, our president required that we do physical education in the schools, which kept us in good shape as kids. We had to do jumping jacks, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, all these different things that kept our bodies healthy. So we weren't overweight. Consequently, we weren't overweighting our animals when we were riding them because we weren't fat. The whole country has gotten so overweight by trying to control a lot of these things artificially that if you just stuck to the natural way of doing things, we wouldn't have these problems. But with the computer age, with the laziness that goes on with it, I mean, I look upon computers as toys. They are nothing but toys.
Yeah.
And they render people very stoic, very inactive. And when you're not active, you're going to get fat. And it's hard to, when you get it on, it's hard to get it off.
When I was a kid, I used to ride my horse to the library in the summertime to check out books.
Yes.
That was before computers.
Right. Yeah, and imagine that. You get the exercise of riding the horse, the book. My God, endless supply out there.
Yeah.
You know, and the nice thing about books, too, is that you can hold them in your hand. You can put a bookmark where you stopped and you can find your place.
Mm-hmm.
Not like Kindle. Oh, you read so far on Kindle and then you go back to try to find where you stop and you got to scroll and scroll and scroll, which creates nothing but stress.
Right.
Stress is not healthy.
No.
So the hormonal changes that take place, especially in teenagers and everything, these equines give us an out for all the excess energy that we have. Guys and girls used to ride together and have a good time doing it, and it didn't require getting into gangs and being mean to each other or anything like that. It was quite the opposite, actually. Yeah, when we were out riding, we'd go out riding, and then the guys would be riding with the girls, and maybe my little sister would be screaming on the back going, "I want to ride this horse by myself." And I would go, "Oh, well, I'll go get on the horse with Greg then."
You know? All right.
Because then I could put my arms around Greg. And then, of course, Greg would really like it. We had a lot of fun back then, too. And we got really innocent things going on, and people were not getting in trouble because it was fairly innocent. And we had the whole neighborhood watching us all the time, too. So there really wasn't anywhere to go hide and do something that you probably shouldn't be doing. The other thing is, too, is that a lot of people these days, they don't have the property to keep an animal. The animals don't get the regular care. The people don't have access to the facilities to do any much training or anything like that. It can become a very frustrating kind of a deal, actually, trying to get good at riding. We do get coaches, and you can trailer your animal to go see a coach once a week. But then again, you're still limited to that that short time that is usually going to be full of holes, and how many people are going to have an extra person there to take pictures, to take videos, so that you can remember what you learned.
Right.
I managed to figure out how to do that. Not most people. Most people can't. Most people just can't simply do it. Like you were saying, you know, you rode to the library. We rode to the quick shop to get a Coke or something like that.
Yeah.
We ride downtown and do that, meet up with people. And there's very few places you could do that anymore, but it used to be they'd have a hitch rail out in front of the store where you could tie up your animal. Kids could ride back and forth to school. They had pens in more rural areas. They had pens where you could actually put your animals in the pens, unsaddle them, unbridle them, put them in the pens, and then ride them home after school. And this made for a lot of things that kids had in common. There was a lot less fighting, if there was any fighting at all. It's, I want to ride the horse.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. Oh, and then if somebody did want to ride the horse, it wasn't inordinate for somebody to say, well, then just jump on with me. We'll ride double. And finding solutions to things like that. We don't have those kinds of solutions today. We've got things that build up frustration, things to make people fearful of big animals. Well, situations whereby people are afraid of ranchers and farmers or anybody in a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
These are some of the friendliest people I know. These are our American patriots that built our country, for God's sake. They're all about love of God, love of family, love of their children, love of work, of creation, of building things, not tearing things down.
Sure.
These people that think they know how to build things and then they go ahead and they try to build something and then it fails, then they don't know how it got that way. Well, I can tell you how these cities got that way and are flooding because they're flooding because you built all these houses so close together and then you put concrete between them with a small little yard here or a small little yard there, and then it rains to be hell and then it floods. And then what do they say? They call it climate change. It's not climate change. It's not.
Yeah.
You don't know how to plan how to build houses so with proper drainage and proper excavation.
Right.
We do that right here at the ranch, and everything we practice here at the Lucky Three Ranch, we don't just build whatever we want wherever we want it. We think about it. People told me a long time ago, oh, don't build your barn so close to the house. You're going to be inundated with flies. I thought, no, I'm not going to be inundated with flies because I'm going to clean my barn every day.
Exactly.
And not only that, I have trouble with the birds building nests in the barn, but I think that I can kill two birds with one stone by putting the fans in the alleyway of the barn, and it'll keep the swallows out, but it'll also keep the flies to a minimum. The other thing that I can do is, as long as I groom my animals once a week and use Tri-Tech 14 fly spray on them once a week, then that will also aid in keeping the flies to a minimum, because the animals standing in the stalls are going to smell like that stuff for a week, and
sure,
it's going to keep the flies away.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing is there are people who are saying that their animals' legs are just getting eaten to bits by flies. They're getting sores up and down the legs of the animals. And I'm sure you've seen it. And so they think that the solution for that is to put socks on their legs.
Yeah.
Well, if you know anything about the coats on these animals, you know that the coats have to stand on end to do their job. The hair does. The hair has to be standing on end, and then if an insect lands on them to try to lay eggs on them, they can flick the skin, which wiggles the hair, which drops the insects off. And if it doesn't drop off that way, then they can reach around and grab it with their teeth or with their manes of their tails. This is why I keep my manes long on my mules. Yeah, I just train them over with Johnson's baby oil, and then they can get really long manes. A lot of you probably have seen Roll's mane. Roll's mane went way below his throat. Yeah. They can use their manes and tails, which is what they are for. Nature has its way of taking care of all these things if we just pay attention and look at it. The other thing is if you keep the stalls and runs clean in your barn, and you've got fans in your barn to disperse these insects and everything, the last thing that is good to do is to keep them in a dirt pen where there really isn't any place for these insects to hide. Don't put the animals out on the pasture 24/7, because if you do, that means their legs are going to be in that grass 24/7. That's where all those insects live. If you limit their turnout time to 5 hours a day, they get their turnout time, then they can come in and they can live in their dirt pen. And you, if there's several in a pen, or if they have their own stalls and runs, it doesn't matter. They can have. They're not going to be bothered by the insects because the insects can't find anywhere to hide in the dirt. They are going to be free from those insects laying eggs into the hair on their legs. So then they're not going to get those sores. Then they have a chance of keeping those insects off of them. I mean, I heard all about jack sores that donkeys were getting, and little Jack Horner, he started getting them, but once I started this protocol, I just treated them with Neosporin when they started to crop up, and he would bite it, and then it would bleed, and I put the Neosporin on, but then it didn't itch, so then he didn't go after it, and he got to be in his dirt pen, except when he was turned out. And my donkeys, I don't turn them out in grass for very long at all, if at all. And keep them out of there, and there's not a mark on any of my animals. None of them. They're not fighting with insects anymore. And it's all because of the protocol.
Sure.
It's just the way you maintain them. But if you don't listen to your animals and observe your animals and the body language that they're giving you about what is bothering them, not just about the maintenance, but about the way that you're training and all of these different things. Is the girth too tight? Is the crupper too tight and flipping the tail up? Is the saddle put in the middle of the back, or is it creeping up on the withers? You know, these are all little things that you need to pay attention to. And instead, people like making money, and they're capitalistically minded, so they like to make new fixes for things.
Yeah.
And when I first got into being recognized as a viable trainer, the first thing these people started sending to me were saddle pads. Oh, try this one. It's got an air thing at the top of the spine here, and it lets the air in over the spine. But the pads were really stiff, and I tried them, and they were still making sores on their backs.
Yeah.
Just in different places. I gave them a fair try. I did. I tried all kinds of them, man, and people were sending all different kinds to me right and left. But eventually, I just decided to go back to my Navajo blankets, double-sided, big enough to fold over double and stick under the saddle. And then with my thoroughbred mules that had a little bit higher spine on them and higher wither on them, then I would add a fleece pad underneath that blanket. And what I found out was that those blankets and fleece pads molded to the back of my animal, and the saddle sat on top. As long as when I put on the saddle, if I ran my arm right down the spine and lifted up under the saddle, the blankets would stay there and create that aeration right over the spine. And because it was sitting like it was just molded to their back, it didn't rock and roll and chafe because it didn't move that much. It just stuck to them. The other thing that I noticed too was that they weren't getting as sweaty. And the sweat that they did get was very, very little on their neck. And it didn't turn to foam. and it didn't turn yellow. It ran clear. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that I feed them, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because in an effort for new modern capitalistic America to put out all these different products, they have to be conjuring up new and better feeds. Of course, mules and donkeys don't need rich feeds. And in fact, if you give them rich feed, it will affect their whole body. And what I've noticed lately is that their hooves are getting softer. And they're falling over. They're caving over on the backsides.
Right.
And so then can't keep their feet hard. Their feet are unhealthy. And then they're colicking. And they're foundering. And then they're this. They get hives. They get allergies. They get, you know, all these things that are developed in a lab. You don't hear about people doing field studies on hundreds of animals. I can say that I have done field studies on literally hundreds of animals in my life because I worked on my mom's ranch where we had 60 head of broodmares, 7 jacks, 8 genets, a few stallions, and we tested live animals over long periods of time.
Yeah.
On my mother's ranch, it was for 6 years, and here it's been 44 years. I reduced the number here, but I kept the protocol the same, and I found the healthy way to maintain these guys. That's why we were able to do so much with rock and roll. They were on their way out when I met them. And rock was worst case scenario with a shattered hip, but I still got him sound. The one thing that you could see after 6 months was just changing the feed. You know, the first day I got him, I just took him off what he was on and put him on my feed schedule. And people are always telling me, got to take him off it slowly. All of these things that people dream up to tell you you can and can't do. I go, well, if it's not good for them, why would I take them off it slowly?
Right.
I'd get rid of it right away, you know? So I was just using common sense in all of this. It's just really important to learn how to read your animals, how to communicate with your animals, because they're going to tell you how they need to be cared for to keep both of you safe, happy, and healthy. And today on this ranch, I've still got 16 animals, most of who are over 30 years old. And they all look young, act young. Their eyes are bright. When they come running at me, their ears are perked up. When I want to take a picture, all I got to do is say, okay, everybody, smile, and all those ears go up, every
yeah.
single one of them, you know, and it's such a joy, and you can't get that joy through shortcuts.
No.
It doesn't come that way any more than really meaningful relationships do not come through shortcuts. I remember those times when we went riding down the road and up into people's properties. And I remember how smiley and happy, congenial all my neighbors were, and how everybody was willing to help everybody else. And we all just derived so much joy just from living around each other and getting to know each other. This world was a much happier place back then, and it didn't have any computers. I'm sure that these guys who were inventing these things, they're numbers guys. I get that. They want to seem like they're really smart. And they are in their own way. If you look at who they really are, they're really kind of isolated people with not too much social experience. You got to be sociable learn how to be friendly.
Oh, yeah. Really, really good information here.
Well, I think so, too. And I got to read your Mule Girls article in Mules and More magazine. And that's another one that I thought was really needed and really exceptional because it basically told all about Mule Girls and what makes them different from just regular girls. Probably the biggest thing is we're not afraid of anything.
Right.
You know? We are true grit in its purest
there you
form.
Go.
But we also know how to get great joy out of life.
Yeah.
And I would encourage anybody who hasn't read that article to go ahead and read that, because it gives us the freedom to be who we want to be. We don't have to have some school teacher tell us at school what gender we're supposed to be or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, we figure those things out by going to school, you know, and
yeah.
becoming who we are.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I kind of shudder to think that maybe these teachers today might think that us tom girls or tomboys need to be boys. No, we don't need to be boys.
No.
We're mule girls.
Right.
I give a person a chance to be who they are. I think nature had it figured out in the first place. I don't think that people should start playing God.
There you go. Now that we've worked up an appetite, I think it's time to go to lunch.
I think you're right, Cindy, and I think we got another good one nailed here.
You got it, and we will talk soon.
We will.
Meredith Hodges can be reached through her website, Lucky3Ranch.com. Her phone number is 1-800-816-7566, and she's on social media, as I am. And if you like the show, hit the subscribe button so you don't miss an episode.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl Stream production.